Random House Audio presents American Desperado. My life, from mafia soldier to cocaine cowboy to secret government asset. By John Roberts and Evan Wright. Read for you by Mark Bramhall, Eric Davies, Mark Deakins, Kimberly Farr, Kirby Hayborn, Thomas Vincent Kelly, Steve Kramer, Meredith Scott Lynn, Jonathan McLean, and Christina Rooney.
Desperado, the horse that I thought would win the Derby and make me famous as something more than a gangster, was a baby when I got him. He hadn't been trained how to run, but he could already fly on the grass. He had good instincts. He didn't like other horses. You don't want a sociable horse. They stay in the pack. You want a horse who likes to run in front of all the other horses. Desperado was a killer. I named him Desperado because I saw myself in his eyes.
John Roberts. Chapter 1. April 2008, Miami. Evan Wright. During a break in the Heat versus Pistons game at Miami's American Airlines Arena, an announcer informs the crowd that a very special celebrity is in the house. Ladies and gentlemen, we have John Roberts, Miami's original cocaine cowboy, with us tonight. Live images of Roberts seated in the arena splash onto the screens in the arena. A physically fit 60-year-old with silver hair combed straight back. Unaware that he is being filmed, Roberts gazes expressionlessly. Deep-set eyes give his face a wolfish, predatory appearance. Fans seated near him stand with their camera phones and take aim. Roberts notices his image on the screens and offers a pained, "Okay, you got me," grin. He puts his arm on his 8-year-old son, Julian, seated beside him. Julian ducks his head into his father's shoulder, but peeks up, grinning, as cameras flash. His dad is the biggest star in the arena. Little more than 15 years earlier, Roberts was a fugitive. His face was featured on FBI Most Wanted posters at U.S. post offices across North America. He fled Miami after the U.S. government labeled him as top American representative of the Medellin drug cartel and charged him with overseeing the importation of billions of dollars of cocaine. Roberts and a small band of American partners had created a veritable FedEx of drug smuggling. They employed secret airfields, listening posts to eavesdrop on Coast Guard communications, and sophisticated homing beacons for tracking cocaine shipped by sea that stymied the U.S. government for nearly a decade. That part of Roberts's story, and the outrageous life he led that epitomized the excesses of Miami's cocaine-fueled boom of the 1980s, was told in the underground hit documentary Cocaine Cowboys, released in 2006. Key aspects of Roberts's extraordinary criminal life remained untold. His rise in a powerful New York mafia clan, the murders that prompted his exile to Miami, his involvement with a CIA official that led to a secret plea deal with the government. Through it all, he possessed an asset not typical of admitted killers, charm. A man who did business with Roberts in his New York mafia days and later joined the priesthood as a result of the experience told me, "John was extremely likable. He was fun to be around. Underneath that was a person capable of very bad things. He is an extreme dichotomy of good and bad. He is a very old story, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde." Roberts's frankness about himself, usually blended with a sly, sardonic humor, can be disarming. In a phone call before we met to discuss telling his full story, he said,
I might be a sociopath. Most of the time I've been on this earth, I've had no regard for human life. That's been the key to my success. I arrive in South Florida the spring of 2008 to begin interviewing Roberts for this book. He insists that I stay with him and his wife, Noemi, and son, Julian, at their house in Hollywood, Florida. He insists that I not rent a car. He'll pick me up. He'll drive. Always. I don't ever want to be in a car with somebody else driving it, he explains. John's accent is New York, but not the tough guy dialect of the streets. He speaks an urbane New Yorkese, like Michael Douglas's Gordon Gekko in Wall Street. We do many hours of interviews in John's car, visiting old haunts, bars, smuggler's docks, murder scenes, with time out to pick up Julian at school and shuttle him to playdates and hockey practice. When Julian is in the car, John drives at the proper speed and questions him about school, like any other involved parent. When John and I are alone in the car, he reverts to old habits. He seems to drive his car, a late model Cadillac, at only two speeds, 75 miles an hour on surface streets and 110 miles an hour on freeways. As he darts in and out of traffic and squeals out of parking lots, driving with John feels like being dropped into a car chase scene in a 1970s movie. I glimpse the rearview mirror, expecting to see elaborate car crashes in our wake and flashing red lights. But John is a precise high-speed driver, never reckless. Rocketing toward a parking space, he flicks the wheel with one hand and backs in. He always parks his car facing out, primed for a quick getaway. John's home is an expansive Spanish modern set against a lake on the inland waterway. Before we enter, he clips blossoms from a jasmine vine, then places them in a vase in the front hall. A friend from his New York days tells me that John has always liked flowers.
In his apartments, he always had a bowl of water with a gardenia blossom floating in it.
John's hospitality is obsessive. Before my arrival, he phoned me on a morning when I happened to be eating blueberries. Now a fresh basket of blueberries waits for me in the refrigerator. Every time I visit, there will be blueberries. In the Roberts household, John does the cooking. French toast for breakfast, pasta and baked fish for dinner. Unless there is an NBA game on or a new episode of Two and a Half Men, his favorite show, meals are eaten at the long plankwood dining table. Noemi is responsible for setting it. She is an energetic presence, 30 years younger than he. Noemi is African on her father's side and Hungarian on her mother's. She and John met shortly after she arrived in America, when she was training in a Miami park for a triathlon. There is an athletic bounce to her movements, and she speaks in an exuberant, bubbling accent, not always easily understood. She pulls me aside before my first dinner in the house and says, "I adore John, but the day I met him, he touched me and my body went numb because his energy is black. John is not human. I love him, but I live as his prisoner. I cannot leave him because his evil is magnetic." Overhearing his wife's commentary, John offers a father knows best laugh.
"Please, Noemi, you'll spoil his appetite."
John's older sister, Judy, who lives nearby, is a frequent dinner guest. A graduate of Emerson College, Judy was a personnel director at a large New York company while John pursued his criminal career. After the birth of Julian by John's previous wife, Judy moved to Florida to help raise him. In her mid-60s, Judy is slim and stylish. At the dinner table, she speaks in a calming voice, directed at Julian when he mumbles about his schoolwork,
then at John.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?